Hi there. If you're hearing this, that means you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed and you're only hearing partial episodes of Founders. If you'd like to access every full episode, all ad-free, you can upgrade by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com. The best way to learn from Founders is by investing in an annual subscription. You save 18%. That works out to less than a dollar a week to learn from some of the greatest minds in history. The monthly option is only $5 a month if you prefer that, and every subscription comes with a 7-day free trial. To encourage you to make a commitment, if you choose the annual plan, I will email you a private podcast feed called Founders Postscript. This is in addition to the Misfit feed. It's just a bonus for those that choose to support Founders by selecting the annual plan. This is for any book that I read that does not fit on Founders, but still something we can learn from. I just released a new episode. Here's an example. I just released a new episode on the Founders Postscript feed based on a book that Elon Musk recommended reading, and it's called The Lessons of History. Upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes or going on your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com. Dr. Seuss is a classic American icon. Whimsical and wonderful, his work has defined our childhoods and the childhoods of our own children. The silly, simple rhymes are a bottomless well of magic. His illustrations are timeless favorites because, quite simply, they make us laugh. The Grinch, The Cat in the Hat, Horton, and so many more are his troupe of beloved and uniquely Seussian creations. Theodore Geisel, however, had a second, more radical side. He had a successful career as an advertising man, and then as a political cartoonist, his personal convictions appearing not always subtly throughout his books. Geisel was a complicated man on an important mission. He introduced generations to the wonders of reading while teaching young people about empathy and how to treat others well. Agonizing over word choices and rhymes, touching up drawings sometimes for years, he upheld a rigorous standard of perfection for his work. Geisel took his responsibility as a writer for children seriously, talking down to no reader, no matter how small. And with classics like Green Eggs and Ham and One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, Geisel delighted readers while they learned. Suddenly, reading became fun. That was from the back cover of the book I'm going to talk to you about today, which is Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel and the Making of an American Imagination, and it was written by Brian J. Jones. So this is another example of a book that I didn't even know existed. And shame on me for that, because Brian J. Jones actually wrote one of my favorite books that I've read for the podcast, and just in general. It's the biography of George Lucas. It's called George Lucas, A Life. I think I covered it back maybe on Founders number 35, in case you haven't already listened to that. Fantastic book. I highly recommend reading it as well. But a listener actually is the one that told me about this book, and I immediately, once I realized it was written by Brian J. Jones, ordered it, and I grew up on Dr. Seuss, so it was just a perfect way to figure out the man behind, the person behind the author. And I want to jump right into the book. There's a lot to cover. I want to talk about the influence of his parents, because that was very interesting what they did, and there's just some really good ideas that positively influenced his life. So his mother's name is Nettie. His father is going to be referred to as T.R., throughout the book, but this is about the influence of his mother, then I'll get to the influence of his father. So it said, Nettie, too, would directly influence Ted's ear for the beat and intonation of words. As she put her son to bed each evening, Nettie would chant a refrain she had often used to sing behind the counter at the Seuss Bakery to inform patrons of the day's pie flavor. So let me stop right there. On her side of the family, they owned a bunch of bakeries. On his father's side, they were German brewers. That's important for the story later on, because his father was running a very successful brewery, and then Prohibition took effect in the United States, and that he had to change careers when Ted was a child. All right, so it goes back to her coming up with a song at her bakery so they could tell the customers the pie flavors, and it says apple, mince, lemon, peach, apricot, pineapple, blueberry, coconut, custard, and squash. At which point she would playfully squash a giggling Ted down into his mattress. Now, this is the important part. This is the reason I'm reading this paragraph to you. Ted later credited his mother for the rhythms in which I write and the urgency with which I do it. And I underline that second part twice. The urgency with which I do it. Ted is a workaholic, as we'll see later on. He fell into the career of Dr. Seuss rather reluctantly. There's a lot of surprises in the book. That's probably the biggest one. It took him an extremely long time, multiple decades, at the same time pursuing other careers before he finally discovered his monumental success becoming Dr. Seuss, which is interesting to me, is the last numbers I've seen, he sold something like 600 million copies of his books. I looked at data for a few years ago. As of, I think, 2018, he was still selling about 4 million books a year, which is just insane when you think about it. But let me go back to, before I lose my train of thought here, the urgency with which I do it. So not only his schedule, which I'll go into later on, is he'd work 8 hours a day every day, no matter what. But he also took him in an unbelievable, you pick up a Dr. Seuss book and it seems like, oh, I could write this in it seems really simple. It's not. He would write 1,000 pages just to get a book down to 60 pages. So this editing and this constant revision, I think, is one key insight to the biography of Dr. Seuss, is how he approached his work. Because we could take that same idea that he took for children's books, and apply it to whatever it is that we're doing during the day. So let me go back to this. Both Nettie and TR, that's his father, would inspire and encourage Ted's love for books. Now, remember what it said on the back cover. His main goal, when he finally embraced being a children's author, is to get people excited about reading. It's something that he's an introvert by nature. One of his true passions was reading. He'd sit in his office and read constantly all day long. He loved history. He loved biographies, of course. But he was distraught at the idea at the time when he was writing, I think he's almost 50 years old, maybe over 50 when he writes Cat in Hat. And the main goal, the main motivation behind that book is the fact that the literacy rates for American children were plummeting. And he thought that was a tragedy. And the reason I bring that up to you is because his parents instilled in him as a child the importance of reading. I think this is a good idea. And so it says, they both inspired and encouraged Ted's love for books. Reading was a pastime the entire family took seriously, leaving well-thumbed books casually on side tables and the pages of the newspaper folded carefully over the arm of a chair. Teaching a child to read is a family setup, Ted said later. It's the business of having books around the house, not forcing them. Parents should have 20 books stacked up on tables or set around the living room. I have way more than that. The average kid will pick one up, find something interesting, and pretty soon they're reading. And this is also an idea that I've intuitively picked up because I've read, my favorite way to read a book is obviously a physical copy. There's nothing that can beat that. But I've read entire books, some of which for this podcast, on my phone through the Kindle app. And that's actually an idea I got from Elon Musk because it's the way, he's busy all the time. He says he's read entire books on his iPhone. So I started doing that. And when you're highlighting and taking notes, it's extremely fast. But then I realized, from my daughter's perspective, is what does she see? She sees her father sitting there looking at his phone. And kids naturally imitate what their parents do. So then what, she's just going to look at a device? No, I'd much rather have her pick up a book. All right, so let's get back to his father. So it says, he was a level-headed man who imparted to his son both a sense of discipline and a foundational decency. This is a really important idea that Ted's about to share with us, something that he's reflects back on. He lives, I think he's 87 years old. He gives this long interview right before he dies. In his office, this idea from his father, which he's learning, 5, 10 years old maybe at this time, younger than 10, is still with him. So it says, while Ted would never be a good shot with a rifle or even fully understands his father's obsession with marksmanship. So his father worked all the time in the brewery. The one thing he would do that when he wasn't spending time with his family is he would compete and he was in this club for marksmanship, to shoot guns and show how precise he could be. But this is the part. So it says, Ted came to appreciate the considerable discipline and commitment it took for his father to hone such an expertise. Ted remembered, oops, I skipped a page. Let me read that again. Ted remembered watching each morning as his father held his rifle steadily over his head for 10 minutes, strengthening his arms and shoulders, and thus ensuring the barrel of his rifle never faltered in the slightest when he aimed and shot. He was an inspiration, Ted said warmly. Later on, he dedicated one of his books. I think he wrote, 60 books, 40, a lot of books. One of his books he dedicated to his father, said it's the finest man he ever knew. Echoes what we learned from that biography of Teddy Roosevelt I did a few weeks ago. He said the same thing about his father. All right, so he says, he was an inspiration, Ted said warmly. Whatever you do, he taught me, do it to perfection. That's a direct quote from his father. Decades later, even after he had become one of the most famous and successful writers in the world, Ted still hung one of his father's paper shooting targets in his office. Check this out. With multiple bullseyes shot out at its center. A constant reminder to do the work necessary to achieve excellence, regardless of the task. So that last line there says, a constant reminder to do the work necessary to achieve excellence, regardless of the task. When I read that, the note I scribbled down is this quote that I listened to over and over again. Comes from Kobe Bryant. It's one of the last interviews he gave before he passed away. And he says, whatever you do, do it to... That's his dad. That's a quote from Ted's dad. This is Kobe. No matter what discipline you are in, there's a common denominator in how we approach our craft. The attention to detail, the level of commitment, those things are the same across the board. That's my message. Don't look at what I did, but how I did it, the how, and then you can transfer that over to any profession and any discipline. And what Kobe is saying, 40 years, or maybe was that 30 years after Ted, after Dr. Seuss dies, is the same thing that Ted learned from his father in the early 1900s. A constant reminder to do the work necessary to achieve excellence regardless of the task. I love that. Going back to another really smart idea that his mother had is just she pumped him up. And she says, my mother overindulged me and seemed to be saying, everything you do is great. Just go ahead and do it. Now, think about that perspective of a mother. When you see a lot of dysfunctional families, it's the opposite. They tell their kids how stupid they are, how they're never going to live up to their expectations. This is terrible, terrible parenting. And I think about that all the time because when you read biographies, many, many decades after usually their parents have passed on, they still talk about their parents. Right before they're dying, their memories are a lot. Not only are they looking back at their own life, but they talk about their parents over and over again. It's extremely important. And then when I read that, I have a series of quotes, videos, some clips from podcasts I always reference over and over again. Sometimes you need extra motivation. You want to draw strength. Maybe you're experiencing periods of doubt like everybody does. And one of this, when I read this sentence, it made me think I have a clip of Kanye West I think of all the time that I love, even to the point where I can imitate what he says. And in the clip, I think he's on like a Tonight Show kind of interview. And he's going off on one of his crazy rants like he always does. But he says, my mother made me believe in myself. No matter how many people tell me, stop believing in yourself. That's how, like, his annotation as well. And I think what Kanye's mother did for him is the same thing that Dr. Seuss's mother's doing for him, that did for him. Everything you do is great. Just go ahead and do it. All right, so more memories and advice from his father. When he wasn't tailing along after his father in the workshop, Ted just plain loved listening to his father talk. Whether he was dispensing advice or telling stories, Ted remembered the two of them lying on their backs in the field directly behind their house on the night of April 20th, 1910, talking in hushed tones as they scanned the sky for Halley's Comet. Other times, they would take long walks together while T.R. entertained his son with stories of life in a brewery. This is hilarious. T.R. would get considerable mileage out of a story about a local attorney he had hired to collect brewery debts. He was a modest and quiet young man named Calvin Coolidge. How funny is that? Perhaps some of Coolidge's famously silent demeanor had rubbed off on T.R. as well. This is advice he gave to his son. You will never be sorry for anything you never said. I don't actually know if that's true, but I understand what he's trying to teach his son there. So now this is about Ted in high school. He's like a lot of people we study on the podcast, self-taught. He's not really interested in formal education. He's a terrible student. For Ted, school was something to be endured, not mastered. So he had a love of drawing. His mother let him draw on the walls. She encouraged him, to pursue things he was interested in. So he's submitting a lot of cartoons to the high school newspaper. Says he would submit several cartoons to the recorder, and most of which are unremarkable. Now, why are they unremarkable? Because like everybody else, he's influenced and he copies the people around him, especially when he's first starting out. Everybody does this. So it says Ted seemed to be aping the styles he saw in comic strips. His drawing would improve over the next 3 years, though Ted would have very little formal art instruction. As his work evolved, Ted would continue to be more influenced by the comic pages than by formal instructions. So they say that over and over again. Ted's high school art, while competent, this is so important, because of course no one starts out being really great at what they do. You have to work at it, right? Ted's high school art, while competent, would give very little indication of the unique and whimsical style to come. So it's around this time Ted's a teenager, and this is when they lose the family business. On January 17th, 1920, Prohibition officially went into effect under the sledgehammer weight of the 18th Amendment. For his efforts to keep Springfield Brewery solvent, T.R. was promoted to president of the company, occupying his new office the very week the sale of intoxicating liquors became illegal. That was it for Springfield Breweries. My father was rather angry about that turn of events, Ted said, with considerable understatement. For weeks, T.R. sat in the living room, head in hand, muttering, "Son of a bitch, son of a bitch." He became very cynical, said Ted. He didn't know what to do with himself. For more than a year, T.R. would mourn the loss of the industry he had grown up in. His father was, so T.R.'s father, Ted's grandfather, was also in the business. He actually sold two breweries and then started investing in real estate as well, the grandfather. T.R. would mourn the loss of the industry he had grown up in, dutifully reporting to work and sitting at his desk in his offices, even as the company was picked to pieces around him, its assets slowly liquidated. Okay, so even though his family was having financial trouble, it was very important for them to send Ted to college. So he goes to Dartmouth. This is the beginning of something that's really, really surprising when analyzing the career of what soon to become, well, not soon, because it's multiple decades of what will become one day, the career of Dr. Seuss. And the note I left myself is finding his true passion yet not doing it for a living, ? And it's something he loved to do, and yet it's sitting there right in front of your face. I guess the lesson here is analyze how you like spending your time, and then maybe you can find a profession and a discipline in there, because Ted loved what he was like. He's going to find his true love of writing cartoons. He did not think he was going to be a children's author. I'll tell you the surprising reason he picked that genre in a little bit. But he loved cartooning. He loved writing humor. He wanted to be funny. And yet he thinks he's going to be an English professor, and he hates the subject. It's very bizarre. So let me get into that in a little bit. It was a floor mate, meaning somebody in the dorm, who helped Ted find his true passion. So he started working at this college. It's like a humor magazine called Jack-O-Lantern. Sometimes they refer to it as Jacko. Ted knew where his people were and what he wanted to do. I think my interest in editing the Dartmouth Humor Magazine began that week. Ted began submitting cartoons to Jacko, and when the first issue of the fall semester was published in late October, Ted found, to his delight, that he had four cartoons featured inside. And before I go into this next paragraph, remember that idea of something smacking you right in the face and not even realizing it, or sitting right before you, not even realizing when he meets his wife, because the statement that she makes may be the most important advice he ever gets from another human being in his life. I'll get there in a minute. Going back to this, he starts freelancing for Jacko, and then he's so good at it. He does so many of them, they invite him to be on the staff. So it says, the work was good enough that in January 1923... Norman McLean, the editor at the time, offered Ted an official spot on Jacko as a member of the art staff. Ted's name would now officially appear in the magazine's masthead. And as far as Ted was concerned, he was on his way to the editor's chair. And this is where we get his dedication and professionalism, his work ethic. As a result, he's just outworking everybody else in the staff. Ted is talking about the editor, what the editor's opinion was of him. He found that it was a workhorse, Ted said later. And so we used to write practically the whole thing ourselves every month. And so let's go back to this idea about, this is so important. Because think about, he's graduating from college, this point in the story, and he's not sure what he wants to do in life. He becomes one of the most iconic writers in history. One of the best-selling writers. That is so far in the future. But at the present day, it's unsure. I don't know what I'm going to do. The thing he loved in college, he was a terrible student. A terrible student. The thing he loved most was cartooning, writing humor. And he still thought, oh, no, you know, this is just like a side thing. I'll just, you know, this is not going to be my career. So it says on June 23rd, 1925, Ted graduated from Dartmouth. Unlike many of his classmates, Ted wasn't entirely certain what to do next. He had no family business to return to and wasn't sure his English degree would be good for much of anything. With a shrug then, he decided to head for graduate school to get his doctorate in English, a subject he didn't even like. How many people do this? Now, the good thing is Ted eventually writes this course, right? The reason I bring this to your attention is think about all the people you know in your life. Look around. So many people just, they don't like what they're doing. Maybe they were influenced by parents. Maybe they're copying for other people around them, whatever it was. But this idea is like, with a shrug, he decided to head to graduate school to get a doctorate in English. Why would you do that? You hate it. With a vague ambition of becoming an English professor, the story right there, the important lesson is he saw that later in his life, there's a fork in the road and he decides to go straight. Most people just pick, they sit on the well-worn tracks. Okay, I can go left or right. No, there's unlimited opportunity in front of you. You just can't copy what everybody else is doing. And again, Ted doesn't get there on his own. His wife, Helen, it winds up being, like I just said, she gives him the most important advice. She's like, you're not even paying, they're going to go to Oxford, that's where they meet, I'll get there in a minute. But she's like, you're not even paying attention to the lecture, all you do is draw these cartoons all day in class, and you're really good at it, why aren't you doing this? And then the light bulb goes off in his mind, he's like, oh, I don't know, that seems to be a good idea, maybe I'll do that. And it still takes multiple decades to get there. So again, a lot of surprising things in this book. One of the surprising things is on the very next page, he's at Oxford. One of his professors is J.R. Tolkien. Unfortunately, it didn't take Ted long to realize that he was in over his head. As a mediocre student who had struggled to attain a C in general English at Dartmouth, a deep drill into Germanic, I don't even know what that word is, at Oxford, even if taught by the brilliant new professor J.R. Tolkien, was bound to be a struggle. So it's at one of these classes that he meets Helen, and he says, this is Ted talking about, instead of taking notes, the pages are full of, you know, these weird creatures. You've probably seen a Dr. Seuss book, you know, they don't look like, they're animals, they don't look like animals, how animals look in real life, right? It says, I think this demonstrates I wasn't very interested in the subtle niceties of English literature. As you go through the notebook, there's a growing incidence of flying cows and strange beasts. And finally, at the last page of the notebook, there are no notes on English literature at all. They're just strange beasts. In fact, the flying cow and strange beasts were what caught the eye of a young woman seated next to him in a lecture, who watched closely as Ted did everything in class but take notes. You're not very interested in the lecture, she told him plainly, then leaned in and pointed at one of his drawings. I think that's a very good flying cow. And now we get to the point where I wrote, this is my own note, maybe the most important thing anyone ever said to him. What Helen saw in Ted was both talent and potential, both of which, as far as she was concerned, were being wasted on English literature. You're crazy to be a professor, she told Ted flatly. What you really want to do is draw. Now, this is Ted at 23, going back to this. He's terrible at being a student, so he drops out, does not get his graduate degree. His year at Oxford had been a bust, and his plans for a teaching career had dissolved with his unattained doctorate. His future was uncertain, and his prospects for employment were cloudy at best. Helen, however, typically thought she knew exactly what Ted should do. Ted's notebooks were always filled with these fabulous animals, she said. So I set to work diverting him. Here was a man who could draw such pictures. He should earn a living doing that. Okay, so after he leaves Oxford, he has to go back home. No money, no prospects, doesn't know what to do. He's still 23 years old. This reminds me, if you remember, if you've read Shoe Dog, and if not, if you've listened to, I think it was Founders number 10, when I covered Shoe Dog. This is very similar to Phil Knight. He gets back from the Army. I think he's 24. You know, he's sitting in his childhood room. He's like, this is my life. I should be a man now, a full adult. Why do I feel this way? Why am I so unfulfilled? Why am I full of uncertainty and doubt? And he goes from this run. And during this run, the opening of Shoe Dog is one of the best openings of any book I've ever read, because it's the inner monologue of Phil Knight deciding, I'm going to pursue my crazy idea. And his crazy idea was the thesis he wrote at Stanford Business School about, hey, why are we letting Adidas and other German companies are dominating athletic shoes. What if I can import the same thing, import Japanese running shoes as a way to to compete with them, as they did with, I think, cameras and other electronics at the time. Anyways, it's fantastic. If you haven't read the book, highly recommend it. Just one of the best autobiographies you're going to find. But anyways, Ted's feeling the same way. This, again, if Ted didn't know Phil Knight, they're separated by a half a century. And yet, this is why, like, I feel so many historical figures in history also did what we're doing, which is reading and studying biographies, because it's the same feelings. We all go through the same things, right? So it says, Ted was back living under his parents' roof again, and he wasn't happy about it. You can switch out Ted for Phil in that picture, or in that sentence, rather. Well, with no job, no teaching certificate, and few prospects, Ted really had little choice but to return, bunking in his second floor bedroom and setting up a drawing board and a typewriter. At age 23, he certainly didn't want to be there. He was determined to make it as an illustrator, and that meant pounding out endless letters to book and magazine publishers in New York, sending around samples of his work, and endlessly pitching one idea after another, very similar to the book. This is a very similar scenario to what we just covered a few weeks ago, Charles Schulz, the cartoonist of Peanuts, doing the same thing. And he also experienced exactly what Ted's going to experience here. Ted explained that he'd been tossed out of the offices of two publishers, two movie studios, three advertising agencies, and the offices of Life and Judge magazines. While he was in the city, he had dinner with five Dartmouth classmates. He's already being stabbed in the chest, right? Now somebody's turning the knife. This is the dinner. A gathering that depressed him, as all five had real jobs and appeared to be on their way to real careers. As for his own prospects, he was playing it by ear. What comes up will come up and will determine my future life, he said. I rather think it will be freelancing for a while. He continued, I don't know, but I know one thing. My policy is to laugh my goddamn head off. Occasionally, now these are heavy sentences here. Occasionally, I depress myself and work myself into one of those delightful funks, and I seek out subway tracks on which to toss myself. And then it strikes me as very comical, and I laugh instead. Despite his darkening spirits, his persistence paid off. In early summer, an editor of the Saturday Evening Post purchased one of his cartoons. They gave him $25, which would be equivalent to about $350 today. It wasn't a princely sum, but when pooled with his savings, it was enough that he could announce to his parents that he was moving immediately to Manhattan. Okay, so he's freelancing. He also starts doing works for Judge Magazine. Now, this is another surprising, like I said earlier, there's a bunch of surprising things I didn't know going into the book. This is another surprising thing. His first career is in advertising. He works in advertising for 17 years. It gives him the financial freedom to pursue cartooning and writing his own books on the side. And it comes, and it happens, it's like a lucky break. It wasn't something he was expecting to do, I guess is a better way to put it. A cartoon appeared in the January 14th, 1928 issue of Judge that Ted would rightly say changed my whole life. In the cartoon, a knight sits upright in a canopy bed, armor stacked on the floor next to him, as a Susian dragon pokes his head menacingly under the canopy, very nearly in the knight's lap. Darn it all, another dragon, says the knight. And just after I'd sprayed the whole castle with Flit. So I guess Flit was a very successful insecticide company at the time. And as an insecticide joke, it was hardly a thigh slapper. But while writing the gag, Ted had fussed over which of the two major brands of insecticide to use for his punchline. In the end, he had simply flipped a coin. It came up heads for Flit, said Ted. It would be the luckiest coin toss of Ted's life. That issue of Judge was picked up in a beauty salon by the wife of Lincoln Cleaves, who was the executive in charge of the Flit insecticide account for an advertising firm. Mrs. Cleaves brought Ted's cartoon to the attention of her husband and suggested they should bring Ted in to talk about creating more Flit ad campaigns. In an era where most print ads were heavy with text or featured large photographs of the product, Ted's Flit advertisement didn't look like any other ad. There's a lesson there. They were intentionally funny, a nearly foreign concept in advertising at the time. Now, Standard Oil owns the company that produces Flit, the insecticide, right? So it says, the Flit campaign would prove would prove so popular, in fact, that Ted would work for them for the next 17 years. That toss of a coin determined my whole career, he said later. More important, the money Ted earned through his advertising work would buy him his artistic freedom. What would eventually become the Dr. Seuss empire would be laid on a foundation built and paid for with Standard Oil money. Thanks for making it to the end of this preview. If you're hearing this, that means you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed, and you're only hearing partial episodes of Founders. If you'd like to access the full episodes, you can upgrade by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player, or you can go to founderspodcast.com. When you do that, you'll immediately unlock every full-length episode. These episodes are available nowhere else. Every episode is about the life story of a person who led such a remarkable life that somebody wrote a book about it. You'll learn from people like Walt Disney, John D. Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, Frank Lloyd Wright, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Andrew Carnegie, Leonardo da Vinci, the Wright brothers, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, Enzo Ferrari, Levi Strauss, Coco Chanel, Larry Ellison, Richard Branson, and many more. You'll learn from the founders of companies like Nike, Rolls-Royce, IBM, Home Depot, Atari, GM, Cadillac, Patagonia, Adidas, IKEA, Sony, and many, many, many more. Many people in history, some of the smartest, most productive people to ever live, took time out of their schedule to read biographies and learn from great people that came before them. By upgrading, you will be doing the exact same thing. Mark Andreessen said it best when he was telling an audience why he spent so much time reading biographies. He said, there are thousands of years of history in which lots and lots of very smart people worked very hard and ran all types of experiments on how to create new businesses and invent new technology. They ran these experiments throughout their entire lives. At some point, somebody put these lessons down in a book. For very little money and a few hours of time, you can learn from someone's accumulated experience. There is so much more to learn from the past than we often realize. You could productively spend your time reading experiences of great people who have came before you and learn every time. The more you know, the more you can do. Do not wait. Don't dilly-dally. Upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes that's available on your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com.